going to be moving from neuroticism to pleasure, although they're actually quite related at moments. And I also wanted to, unfortunately, add even more complexity and nuance to some of the things that we've been discussing today. I want to thank my co-authors, Jennifer Hirsch and James Trussell, who should take credit for all the good things about this presentation and none of the mistakes, so thank you to them. I want to very briefly overview the gaps in the literature that pertain specifically, I think, to pleasure and pregnancy ambivalence, review our qualitative study methodology, and present our findings in three categories of pregnancy, of pleasure related to pregnancy ambivalence that came out of the data, and I'll end with some implications. So we all know in this room that unintended pregnancy remains a very salient public health and policy concern. And we know more and more about the socio-demographic patterns of unintended pregnancy, but we know less about the psychological predictors, although Pamela was getting at that a little bit in her presentation. One thing that has been mentioned in the literature as a possible psychosocial factor is pregnancy ambivalence, which John actually suggested we should potentially dash as a concept and talk more about complexity and nuance, and I couldn't agree more. These studies that I cite here tend to consistently find that women, often always women in these studies, who say they're unsure about whether they're really certain whether they want a pregnancy, are much less likely to be using contraceptives consistently. What we don't know, however, is the social, sexual, and emotional processes at work in shaping pregnancy ambivalence. Which women are most likely to be experiencing this and why, at what moments in their life, and particularly, we know little about what the sexual appeal of considering a pregnancy with a partner might bring for women. So we know little about whether unprotected sex and or pregnancy ambivalence may be pleasurable or may heighten the sexual experience. And this is, I think, particularly striking when we contrast it to what we know around HIV risk. Researchers have begun to consider the psychosocial benefits of taking HIV-related risks. There's been some wonderful research among gay men in the U.S. in particular that men might not want to wear condoms even though they're well aware of their HIV risk, but in fact it can enhance intimacy, enhance the eroticism of the encounter. Pregnancy, of course, is very different from HIV risk. It's potentially generative, relationship-affirming, and other things, and yet we've done little research to understand why women and men might be turned on by this notion when they engage in sexual relations. So this led us to ask a fairly multifaceted research question. To what degree do women and men find pleasure in the possibility of a pregnancy with a particular partner? How does this help people meet certain sexual, social, and emotional needs? And how can this explain contraceptive use and unintended pregnancy? And to answer this, we looked and conducted an exploratory study of this qualitatively. We conducted in-depth, open-ended sexual history interviews with 36 respondents from Metro Atlanta, where myself and Jennifer Hirsch were at the time of data collection. We wanted to focus on women, but of course we thought it would be really interesting to include men for comparison purposes. They've been relatively neglected in studies of this topic. We looked at social class as our main stratifier with our respondents. I'm not going to be talking too much about social class differences in this presentation, but it's been something of great interest to us in some of our other papers. We also used strategic sampling to capture other variables that we all know are very correlated with contraceptive use and unintended pregnancy, including age, relationship status, parity, and race and ethnicity. I'm going to just not go over this in depth, but if you could pay attention to some of these numbers over here, our average age was 35. About two-thirds of our respondents had never been married. We had about half whites, half African Americans. Most of them were not parents currently, meaning that they didn't have children in their household that they were raising. And then this is, again, a very complicated table that before I flash it up, let me just stress, half of respondents had experienced at least one lifetime unintended pregnancy, and I'm defining that here by the conventional measures of mistimed or unwanted. And because several respondents had experienced more than one unintended pregnancy over the course of their lifetime, the average, there were 28 unintended pregnancies out of the sample. So in other words, 50% of respondents had experienced an unintended pregnancy and 57% of pregnancies were unintended. So I will skip this in the interest of time, forgive me. What I really want to do is focus now on how pregnancy ambivalence affected contraceptive use in the sample and how that was related to sexual pleasure. There were three categories that came up that I'll be talking about. The first is this active eroticization of pregnancy risk, which is what I was expecting maybe to find it in the data, but then found all these other forms of pleasure as well. So sometimes an individual or couple didn't intend a child, but was aroused by the idea of pregnancy in the heat of the moment. So the idea of baby could be appealing, even if the reality of a child was not. Pregnancy fantasies could foster connection with a partner or indulge one's own procreation potential. It could be very seductive for certain people to consider what it would be like to create a life, either on their, in conjunction with a loved one, or the notion of just, wow, I could be a parent, or I could create a child. That's really exciting for some folks at certain moments in their lives. This was most likely to occur in long-term relationships when one felt particularly connected to a partner, but not always. Here are a couple of qualitative examples of this. Alex, a 28-year-old middle-class woman, she didn't like hormone-based methods, so she used condoms with her partner, not consistently, because she often, as we see, got caught up in the heat of the moment with her partner. She says, sometimes when I was having sex with him, I would just kind of lose my mind a little bit and want to have a baby with him so badly. It was like I can't get close enough to him or connected up enough with him, and conceiving a child would be the closest we could get. Because they use condoms inconsistently, Alex experienced an unintended pregnancy. Here's what she said about it. It seemed amazing that we could create this life together, and I suppose part of us did want to keep the pregnancy, especially since at that point we imagined we'd be together forever. It was romantic to imagine building a permanent life with him, but I was in my first year of law school. I wasn't ready to have a child. I wasn't ready to give up my plans. She sought an abortion, and the relationship dissolved after about another year or two. Martin is a 38-year-old man who had a number of sexual partners. I think he said 500. I think we got it down to 300 through triangulation. He's a fairly busy guy. But he described his first sexual encounters with a young woman named Frances with this tremendous tenderness. And here he talked about they didn't use condoms or any other contraception when they had sexual relationships. And here he speaks about why that was. He said, I certainly realized she could get pregnant. In a way, I was hoping she would. And I asked, what made you interested in getting her pregnant? And he said, she was real pretty, looked like an Indian. Her attitude was just lovely. I felt like it would be nice to have a baby with a person like that. So Martin didn't have a desire to be a parent, but he was very turned on by the notion of impregnating this very desirable and beautiful young woman. She did not experience an unintended pregnancy, I should say, but potentially could have, and these concepts are at work here. So another category is a subtler eroticization of pregnancy risk. Sometimes a baby was neither consciously intended nor unintended, and people would sort of talk about it. Pregnancy wasn't, it was not wanted, or sometimes it was wanted in the future. Along these lines, unprotected sex could help people feel connected with their partners and or could relieve them of making fertility decisions. This notion of leaving it up to fate, which I think many of us are familiar with clinically, also more common within the context of long-term relationships. So Joseph, 30-year-old man, who talked about a relationship with a woman in which they used condoms about 30% of the time, and I asked him why sometimes and not others, and he said, well, we could have children. We did think about it, just not right then. If I don't know a girl at all, I'll definitely use a condom. But if I've been with a girl for a while, we're really into each other, a pregnancy wouldn't have been terrible, even though we weren't trying to have kids. So this isn't necessarily fantasizing about a pregnancy with his partner, nor is it trying to avoid one at all costs. As he said, it wouldn't have been terrible. Lydia is a 32-year-old woman who described a relationship with a man who would turn out to be her husband. Her period was late. She hadn't been planning a pregnancy, had been actively trying to avoid it with contraception. But when the pregnancy test was negative, she was really upset and described crying in the bathroom. And she says, I was relieved but also sad. I had almost gotten excited about the idea of making a baby with him. It was something I wanted to do with him, just not right then. So this woman, had she had a positive pregnancy test, might very well have said she was happy about the pregnancy, in keeping with some of the previous presentations. A third category of pleasure that emerged from the data was an escapist pleasure of being swept away by a pregnancy, and this was more a post facto kind of pleasure, sort of once the pregnancy had occurred, rather than in the heat of the sexual moment. Even when not planning or hoping for a baby, several respondents came to embrace unintended pregnancy as a way to foster relationships, cultivate a new family, and in particular, potentially escape the hardships of one current one's current life. And as you can imagine, this was much more likely to happen among the poor and working class women who had very different educational and employment opportunities than middle class women, so an unintended pregnancy could be imbued with potential in a way that it would not be for middle class women. This is not a new finding. Lots of folks have shown this with poor and working class women, but here we frame this phenomenon as part of a broader model of the pleasures of pregnancy, even in the absence of intendedness. I'm gonna skip Destiny, but go to Rose here. Rose is a 50-year-old woman who described growing up in a family with family of 10 children, a mom who's working a lot and a dad who wasn't around. She talked about the place where she would go to escape was called the Magnolia Ballroom, which was this dance hall down the street, and there was a young man who paid a lot of attention to her. It was very exciting. She says, I couldn't get the things I needed. I had 5 dresses to wear for 7 days of the week. There were some basic things I didn't have then. The Magnolia Ballroom, it was a place where I could just get away, get nice things. He bought them for me, new clothes, jewelry sometimes, flowers. He gave me something to ease me from what I had at home, something to get me away, have better things in life. I only had 5 dresses. They ended up having sex. She ended up getting pregnant. And she says, I felt good when I found out I was pregnant. I felt like I knew I'd wanted to have children at some point. I wanted out of my mother's house. I wanted to make a family. Sometimes it don't work out like that. So even though she had not been intending to get pregnant, this pregnancy became imbued with hope for her. Unfortunately, the relationship dissolved, although they did get married and stayed together for 3 more pregnancies, which were all unintended. What I want to do briefly is draw some connections between what we found here and some of the literature that connects. The active eroticization of pregnancy risk, I think, upholds the literature on barebacking among gay men that I mentioned earlier. Among these men, sometimes, desire for closeness, greater physical pleasure of skin-on-skin sex, or even hope for shared disease with one partner may lead to condomless sex. And again, I want to reiterate how very different pregnancy risk is than HIV risk in terms of its potential meaning for a relationship and one's future. The passive eroticization of pregnancy risk upholds the notion of passive preceptors that Stanford et al. Has spoken about, as well as the notion that unprotected sex can stem from feelings of love, romanticism, and or need for connection. So Stanford applied this term to people who say they don't want a child but who are not using contraception. I had a friend of mine use the term not trying to get pregnant. And Bartz et al. in a Daily Diary study found a really interesting finding that when on days when women, or these were adolescents, felt particularly in love with or connected with their partners, they were less likely to use contraception. And then the final category, the pleasures of being swept away by an unintended pregnancy, just reiterates this notion that in resource-poor settings in which young women depend on men for social affirmation and financial support, unintended pregnancies can become imbued with optimism and promise. And this connects with John's early point that unintended pregnancy can really be often a failure of health and social systems and not individual women's contraceptive use. So taken together, we hope we've created a heuristic for some of the sexual emotional pleasures involved in creating a baby with someone, even when pregnancy intention is absent. It helps us understand how lack of contraceptive use isn't always a failure to do something, but can actually help people achieve more immediate goals around intimacy, emotional connection, and or sexual pleasure. So when women don't use contraceptives or when men don't use contraceptives, it isn't always because they don't know about them or don't have access to them, but in fact have mixed feelings about pregnancy. I hope that we can see this concept explored a lot more in future behavioral studies in terms of how people can benefit psychologically, socially, and sexually from taking risks around pregnancy. The tricky thing is going to be putting this to work at a clinical and programmatic level. What do you do if someone actually does fit into some of these pleasure categories? How do we address his or her contraceptive needs? I wish when I had done contraceptive counseling, I had done a little bit more questioning around, tell me about your partner. Do you think about having a baby with him or her? And if so, maybe we should think about a non-barrier method for you. Of course, that does nothing to protect the person from HIV and STIs, though. And I, of course, should make a caveat that pleasure is only one piece of the model. So structural inequality, in my mind, is really the biggest predictor of unintended pregnancy across the board. So pleasure is only one piece of it, and yet it's a very important piece and fun one. And I should make a plug here for the Sexuality Task Force. If you're interested in this topic, please see me or other people involved in the Sexuality Task Force, because we're trying to get more panels on these sort of topics and more research going in this area. Thank you very much. First, yeah. Well, and in some ways, if the pregnancy is the result from this sort of state of not trying results in happiness, there's no problem, right? But if, in fact, I mean, as we saw, several of the pregnancies that were kind of fantasized about ended in abortion, and so there's some way that we could be better servicing those folks in some level. Still doing some thinking. I think one that I didn't stress enough, but my fellow panelists have stressed, men's pregnancy ambivalence and pregnancy intentions are hugely important, and I think we need to be including them more in reproductive health services or addressing this issue with men a lot more. That would help us, I think, try to better get a sense of discord between couples with intendedness. I do think that one of the standard questions that clinicians should be asking women and men when linking them with a suitable contraceptive method would be, have you thought about a pregnancy with your partner? Have you fantasized about a pregnancy with your partner? And therefore, gosh, maybe we should think about something that you don't have to use in the heat of the moment. I mean, this research was inspired by my work with abortion clients who talked about having condoms in the bedside table, but getting caught up in the heat of the moment. So for those women, I would love for them to be on a kind of contraception that they didn't have to think about in the heat of the moment. But again, that does nothing for HIV and STI risk. So at least to put it on our clinical and programmatic map, I mean, the conceptual map of things that explain this is a first step, and then I think hope we'll find better clinical implications. Yeah, you had a question. Right. Yeah, and this points to a problem, data collection around unintended pregnancy, and that I was interviewing about these things retrospectively, so people have a very different experience of them. But in some ways, that makes it even more striking that years later they were able to say, it was the idea of a pregnancy in the heat of the moment was sexy to me, but afterwards it wasn't. I aborted. So I would rather do more longitudinal studies or daily diary studies. But in terms of interviewing, I followed sort of my mentor Jennifer Hirsch's advice more around ethnographic interviewing and really spending a lot of time with these folks. So I didn't get into the unintended pregnancies until usually our second meeting, and we had already covered a lot of ground. But it's like anything. I mean, especially doing sexuality research, people want to talk about these things a lot more than we think they do. So it's not that difficult. Well, we had so few respondents that it was very easy to find people. I had hoped originally to sample within two neighborhoods in Atlanta that captured the variables of interest, but wrote up one email recruitment message saying, are you interested in this study? We paid people $40 for their participation because it was about a three-hour interview. And we got hundreds of calls, hundreds and hundreds of calls. So once that was forwarded around, so it was really a matter of figuring out what cells we wanted among the respondents, you know, poor women, middle-class women, poor men, middle-class men, range of races and ages and things like that, and then matching them within. I can give you more information on strategic sampling, but it's used by more sort of an ethnographic approach than a demographic approach. The email, who knows? I mean, once someone got it, it went to tons of listservs. And what's interesting, I actually heard from a lot of poor and working class respondents based on the email. But I posted flyers. I walked around a lot of poor and working class neighborhoods and handed out cards, talked to men on subway bus stations. You know, are you interested in participating? There was no problem finding lots of respondents. So, yeah. Yeah. You all are really asking the absolutely right questions, and I haven't come up with a specific answer for you yet. The one I mentioned earlier would be a biggie. Tell me, have you fantasized about having a pregnancy with this partner? What would it mean to have a pregnancy with this partner? And if the person said, yes, I really have, or I'm turned on by the idea of that with this partner, maybe someday, if not right now, then I might advocate for longer acting, a non-episodic method. If other people have suggestions on how to address this at the programmatic level, I'd love to hear them. And I know many of you have had more clinical experience than I, so I hope we can keep generate. I'm sorry I can't answer your question any better than that. Yeah, Jennifer, you had your hand up.
Because you weren't listening at all. No, I mean, this has been a very important concept for the movement to get reproductive, services to women, reproductive education to men and women. There's a really important reality here. I mean, this is a real phenomenon. As everybody's pointed out, there's multiple layers of whatever this phenomenon is. It's pleasure, it's, multifactorial and includes, multiple layers. So, I mean, it's very complicated, but it's a really important, and many of these unintended pregnancies end in abortion, which is highly stigmatizing, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really important. I think it's been a very useful advocacy concept. I think we could probably refine, I'm interested in seeing how we refine the advocacy concept to something that's more meaningful to the electorate. Unintended pregnancy doesn't sell in Peoria. I mean, I think mistimed pregnancies and some other concepts may do better. Maybe. I don't know. And let's open it up to the entire panel. Do you want to add some more to that? Okay, and then we'll go.
Just wanted to reply to the poor women of color. African American women were targeted for those programs. This actually in the past did cause some, women of color not reaching those clinics. So there is a trust to be built first before even starting reaching those populations, I think.